Here it is!
From deep inside your audio device of choice.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, what a week just passed. It held its own parade of bizarre and fascinating stories. In the wake of a humbling debate, Donald Trump announced he's going to be unveiling his own brand of cryptocurrency. Finally, a product you shouldn't trust from a man you can't trust. Speaking of that debate, my sense is that long after most people forget what was said, and that won't be easy given some of the statements, what will linger in the mind was a visual memory of a really angry man. Not sure that was in the game plan. And then there were the cats and dogs of Springfield, Ohio. An enduring gift to the comedy world. Not only because they weren't raining. The woman behind the original Facebook post spreading that claim says she had no firsthand knowledge of any such incident and is now filled with regret and fear as a result of the ensuing fallout. It just exploded into something I didn't mean to happen, said Erica Lee, a Springfield resident. She told that to NBC News at the end of the week. She had posted on Facebook about a neighbor's cat that went missing, adding that the neighbor told Lee she thought the cat was a victim of an attack by her Haitian neighbors. The neighbor said she heard about the attack from a third party. So there you go. Why it may have gained such purchase goes back to a true story, ladies and gentlemen, I'm going to share with you for the first time here on the radio. In 1962, in the summer, I was in New York, always a great place to be in the summer. I was working at you may find this hard to believe, at an advertising agency. And it was my first time in New York, and I was standing in a line, checkout line in a supermarket. And on the newsstand at the checkout counter was a then local publication, it wasn't national yet, called The Enquirer, with an E, which I thought was novel. And then I looked above the name of the paper at the headline at the top of the page. And here's what it said. Quote, "The truth about West Coast barbecues, they cook and eat dogs and cats." Unquote. Guess who else was in New York that summer? The week also was notable for the explosion, or the mini explosion, I guess, of endorsements following that debate. Taylor Swift endorsed Kamala Harris. Dick Cheney had done so already, I think. And later in the week, an endorsement of Kamala Harris came from really an unusual source, Alberto Gonzalez. He called Donald Trump the most serious threat to the rule of law in a generation. That was a quote from him. In case you've forgotten who Alberto Gonzalez was, here's a timely memory check. Hello, welcome to the show.
I was loyal to George Bush whenever he'd call, even if he wanted nothing at all. I was loyal on the rise, I was loyal on the fall, 'cause even I know what the point of the fall is. Give the critics the head of Alberto Gonzalez.
Gonzalez.
The Geneva Conventions I helped redefine. calling them quaint. I think that quote was mine. 'Cause certain detainees were just over the line. In a room with top lawyers, it's clear where the gall is. In the legalese head of Alberto Gonzalez.
Gonzalez.
The first Hispanic was a badge I'd wear with pride. It got me upstairs and it got me inside. In Texas, George Bush named me to his Supreme Court. Could the big one be next? I'd sure need his support. So my advice was the most approving sort. If I wanted the robe, I'd give nothing but solace and let Bush be the head of Alberto Gonzalez. We wanted to change prosecutors for friends. A big Senate hearing is where that trail ends. The truth doesn't break, but it certainly bends. I give a display of what total lack of recall is. Just a memory hole in the head of Alberto Gonzalez.
Gonzalez.
The first Hispanic was a badge I'd wear with pride. It got me upstairs and it got me inside. I'll spend time with my family. I'll spend time alone. I'll sit by my computer. I'll sit by my phone. Hoping that my old friend will just throw me a bone. Even though I know how unlikely that call is. So I'll take back the head of Alberto Gonzalez.
From the edge of America, from the home of the homeless, I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, ladies and gentlemen, news of the godly. A foundation that supports a prominent Catholic movement in France...
the French.
...is changing its name after revealing nearly 20 fresh abuse allegations against the famed Abbé Pierre, a formerly beloved Capuchin priest... who died in 2007. A statement earlier this month released by a solidarity movement with over 400 member associations in his name, it seeks to combat poverty and homelessness worldwide, detailed new allegations of sexual abuse and misconduct by Pierre, who founded the movement way back in 1949. A previous July report from the same organization had detailed allegations involving at least 7 victims, including one who was a minor at the time of her alleged assault. Emmaus, France, said it first received a report from a woman accusing Pierre of sexual assault last year. It commissioned a consulting firm to set up a system to allow additional alleged victims to come forward. Since then, at least 17 additional victims have come forward, alleging sexual violence committed by Abbé Pierre against girls and women. In light of those allegations against its founder, the Abbé Pierre Foundation has decided to change its name and has begun the necessary paperwork. Okay, that settles that. And the mother of 2 underage girls married to religious leader Samuel Rapilee Bateman testified Wednesday in the trial of two Arizona men accused of aiding and participating in Bateman's child sex abuse in the Phoenix area. Julia Johnson, a former member of the Fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, that's a breakoff from the Mormons, told the jurors that four of her daughters were given to Bateman in spiritual marriages in 2020. Two of them were 10 and 14 when Bateman married them and began having sex with them. He married his first child bride, a 9-year-old daughter of Johnson's husband, Moroni. In 2020, Johnson said Moroni and a co-defendant helped Bateman amass more than 24 wives by asserting himself as a prophet and spiritual leader to replace, here's a name you may remember from the hole where memories go, Warren Jeffs, who led that same Mormon offshoot until his arrest in 2006 and subsequent life imprisonment for this same kind of stuff. Quote, it was a devastation, Johnson said, to the community's response to Bateman's assertion of power. Because Jeffs was in prison, no marriages could be approved in the community in Colorado City, Arizona. But Bateman preached that men could receive permission directly from God and spread his new teaching to justify taking wives, Johnson said. More news of the godly. Over several decades, at least 10 priests and missionaries moved to Papua New Guinea after they had allegedly sexually abused children or had been found to do so in the West. That's according to court records, government inquiries, survivor testimonies, news media reports, and comments by church officials. These men, according to the New York Times, were part of a larger pattern. At least 24 other priests and missionaries left New Zealand, Australia, Britain, and the United States. Four Pacific Island countries like Fiji, Kiribati, and Samoa under similar circumstances. In at least 13 cases, their superiors knew these men had been accused or convicted of abuse before they transferred to the Pacific, according to church records and survivor accounts. It's been widely documented the church has protected scores of priests from authorities by shuffling them to other places. What sets these cases apart is the remoteness of the islands the men ended up in, making it harder for authorities to pursue them. The relocation also gave the men access to vulnerable communities where priests were considered beyond reproach. And four chapters in a shocking 700-page report on historical sexual abuse at religious schools in Ireland start with a content warning, according to the Irish Independent. These chapters are the accounts from those who endured and survived extreme sexual violence and abuse in day schools and boarding schools across Ireland. Quote, reading these accounts of abuse may be extraordinarily difficult, particularly for those who've been abused or whose loved ones have been abused. The scale of sexual abuse revealed in the report published this week is staggering. It was written by a senior counsel, Mary O'Toole, contacted 73 religious orders that ran or are still running schools. Over 40 had records of historical sexual abuse allegations across 22 countries. The report said sexual abuse happened between the 60s and the 90s, the highest reported incidents occurring back in the 70s. The report found 42 religious orders had combined records of almost 2,400 allegations of sexual abuse in hundreds of schools. The allegations were made against 884 people, many of whom were priests or teachers in positions of trust with constant access to vulnerable children. Over half of those accused are now dead. The overwhelming majority of allegations relate to the sexual abuse of boys. News of the godly, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And lest we forget our friend the atom, a long robot entered a damaged reactor at the Fuk nuclear plant this week. It began a 2-week high-stakes mission, according to the AP, to retrieve for the first time a tiny amount of melted fuel debris from the bottom of the reactor. The robot's trip is a crucial initial step for what comes next, a daunting decades-long process to decommission the plant and deal with large amounts of highly radioactive melted fuel inside three reactors that were damaged by that earthquake and tsunami. Specialists hope the robot will help them learn more about the status of the cores and the fuel debris. TEPCO is limiting daily operations to 2 hours to minimize the radiation risk for workers in the reactor building. The melted fuel debris has been kept cool and has stabilized. The aging of the reactors poses potential safety risks, and the melted fuel needs to be removed and relocated to a safe place for long-term storage as soon as possible, experts say. Where's that safer place? How about your house? An understanding of the melted fuel debris is essential to determine how best to remove it, store it, and dispose of it, according to the Japan Atomic Energy Agency. It'll also provide more clues about how exactly the meltdown 13 years ago played out. Some of it is still a mystery. The melted fuel sample will be kept in secure canisters and sent to multiple labs for analysis. If the radiation level exceeds a set limit, the robot will take the sample back into the reactor. Quote, it's the start of a process, said Lake Barrett, who led the cleanup at Three Mile Island. It's a long, long road ahead, he said. The goal is to remove the highly radioactive material, put it into engineered canisters, and put those in storage, unquote. Removal of the melted fuel is initially planned to start 3 years ago. It's been delayed by technical issues. The government says decommissioning is expected to take 30 to 40 years. Some experts say it could take as long as a century. The atom really is our friend. And now, the apologies of the week. Just one apology this week.
We're so sorry.
But it's a good one. Dateline Atlanta, the mother of the teenager accused of killing 4 people during last week's shooting at a Georgia high school, has apologized to the victims' families in an open letter, while insisting that her son is, quote, not a monster, unquote. Quoting again to the parents and families of those affected by the tragic events at Appalachee High School, I want to say that I am so sorry from the bottom of my heart. That's a quote from Marcy Gray, the mother of 14-year-old Colt Gray, in a letter that she provided to CNN. Because she wanted it to be known nationwide and around the world. The letter comes a week after the shooting, as questions mount about the efforts to prevent the shooting, following a revelation that the very same mom, Marcy Gray, had called the school prior to the attack to warn of a, quote, extreme emergency, unquote, by a non-monster. The shooting left 2 teachers and 2 students dead at the high school. 7 others were wounded. Quote, we are all living in a living nightmare right now, and I will personally never forgive myself for what has happened, she wrote. My son Colt is not a monster. He is my oldest baby. He is quiet, thoughtful, caring, funny, and extremely intelligent. Please pray for him and the rest of our family, as I am praying for all of you every moment of every day. CNN is reaching out to victims' families for comment on the letter. Haven't seen that yet, but that's the apology of the week. And now, it's a crypto winter. The Indonesian crypto exchange Indodax was hacked this week. Over $22 million worth of various tokens were stolen. The exchange confirmed a security breach by pausing platform operations for, quote, maintenance, unquote. There were indications of compromised social media activities, such as a suspicious giveaway announced on Instagram, suggesting further security issues. The attack was performed on Indodax's, quote, hot wallets. Hot wallets! Where is Donna Summer when we need her? Hot wallets! The former CEO of a small Kansas bank was sentenced to more than 24 years in prison for looting the bank of $47 million, which he sent to cryptocurrency wallets. Not necessarily hot ones. They were controlled by scammers who had duped him in what's called a pig butchering scheme that appealed to his greed, according to prosecutors. Who knew the CEO of a small Kansas bank had greed? The massive embezzlement by ex-CEO Sean Haynes in a series of wire transfers over just 8 weeks last year led to the collapse and FDIC takeover of Heartland Tri-State Bank in Elkhart, Indiana. No, Kansas. There's an Elkhart in Kansas. One of only five U.S. banks that failed last year. Haynes also swindled funds from a local church, an investment club, and a daughter's college savings account to transfer money to buy cryptocurrency, as the scammers insisted they needed more funds to unlock the supposed returns on his investments. Police in the small European country of Montenegro said they've arrested the co-founder of the alleged crypto scam, FutureNet, which is believed to have stolen approximately $21 million from unsuspecting victims. Anybody keeping count on the totals of all this? Roman Ziemian was arrested in Montenegro's capital city. Yes, Podgorica. According to a statement released by authorities this week, the police directorate said it seized devices and items it suspect Ziemian used for his alleged crimes. He'd been living in Montenegro under a false name, even harder to pronounce. He was sought by both Polish and South Korean law enforcement on charges of money laundering, fraud, and theft. He faces the threat of life imprisonment if he's extradited to South Korea. In March 2019, Poland's Consumer Protection Agency warned FutureNet might be operating as a classic pyramid scheme scam. A scheme scam. Bitcoin mining, yeah, there's more. Bitcoin mining firm Rhodium Enterprises has filed for voluntary bankruptcy, Chapter 11 style, in Texas, revealing liabilities of up to $100 million. This includes six subsidiaries, all with the name Rhodium in them. According to the document, the company's debts remain between $50 and $100 million. Its total assets are between $100 and $500 million. The bankruptcy follows reports of financial distress under the company's umbrella. Other Bitcoin mining companies have sought similar protection in the past. The company will be able to reorganize its debts while carrying on. I'll give you their number later. The FBI just dropped its annual report examining the costs of crypto-related cybercrime. According to the Register, it painted a predictably grim picture. Total losses in the U.S. exceeded $5.6 billion last year, a year-on-year increase of 45%. More than 69,000 complaints were made to the FBI's Internet Crime Complaint Center last year, the bulk of these coming from people aged 60 and older, highlighting just how vulnerable older generations are to internet and particularly crypto scams. Investment scams are the primary driver of the sharp increase in crypto-related losses. The vast majority of the cases are geared toward promising malleable victims huge returns. Huge, I said, from their investments. Instead, the scammers just take the money and run. A tried and tested method. And finally, Friend.tech, the crypto social network built on Coinbase's Buzzy Base blockchain, is shutting down. That closing leaves investors in the lurch. The project's creators are walking away with some $44 million. Since Friend.tech launched a little over a year ago, it generated almost $90 million in fees. Half of those fees went to the project's development team. Investors haven't been so lucky. The Friend token, that's a piece of cryptocurrency, declined 98% since its launch last May. It fell a further 21% on the shutdown news before partially recovering. It's a blockchain-based social network that lets users invest in influential individuals by buying so-called keys, tokens that grant access to exclusive chat rooms. It announced this week it had transferred administrative and ownership rights for the code that backs the protocol to a null address. Simply put, while the friend.tech protocol will still exist, the project's creators have irreversibly revoked the ability to make changes to it or to collect fees. Goodbye, friend.tech. This is Le Show, and I'm delighted to have a return appearance by a friend of the show, a friend of mine, actually. The show doesn't have relationships. He's been on this program a couple times before, and he's got a new book out, I should mention that at the top, called Taming Silicon Valley, coming out next week, I believe. He's a psychologist. Tell me your actual doctoral title, if you would, sir.
I'm very hard to pigeonhole, but my official title is emeritus professor at New York University.
Okay.
But I've done many things, and it's hard to nail me down.
This is Gary Marcus. He's now best known, I think, in this country as a notable skeptic on the subject of AI, artificial intelligence, and that is the subject of his new book. Gary, before we do anything else, I just read at a website called The Information, I haven't read the piece because I don't subscribe, but I read the title. I am an author who proudly writes his books with the aid of generative AI.
Yes, I skimmed that piece. I did not read every word of it, and perhaps I will be careful. I don't know that that piece is representative of many artists as opposed to a particular perspective. I think, you know, artists are always going to explore new technologies, and there's nothing wrong with that. You know, for example, musicians started using synthesizers. Guitars are a kind of technology harmony is a kind of technology. So I'm all for artists using technology. I think if you hit three keys and press go, that you probably, there was not a lot of artistic impulse there, and maybe you shouldn't get a whole lot of credit for it. But, you know, that's a complicated question, let's say.
Okay, well, let's start with some simpler stuff. In both your book and on your blog, you've pointed out some problems that AI's most notable new representative, GPT-4, has had with stubborn things called the facts. You have a question you asked it regarding comparative weights of bricks and feathers.
Yeah, I mean, there are many cases. I used the word relationship before. I would say that GPT-4's relationship with the truth is very distant. So it stores a whole bunch of information, not quite memorized, and it tries to make analogies to it. In the particular example from my book that you're referring to, it gets confused as to what weighs more, and it makes up something that sounds grammatical but is completely off the wall. And it often does that sort of thing, whether you're talking about just like basic physics, or I give another example in the book where it makes up an allegation that I have a pet chicken named Henrietta.
Yes.
These systems don't actually get grounded in facts. They can memorize facts, but they take everything that they learn, break it into a lot of little pieces, and then reconstruct. And the reconstruction process is very sloppy, like a loose JPEG or something like that. And so what you get out is not necessarily what you put into it. And then furthermore, people try to ask it things that aren't particularly memorized, and you hope for the best. For the particular example you're talking about, it was which weighs more, a kilogram of bricks or 2 kilograms of feathers? And it winds up saying, so in a vacuum, a kilogram of bricks and 2 kilograms of feathers would weigh the same. But in air, 2 kilograms of feathers would weigh slightly less than a kilogram of bricks. It's just total nonsense. Mm-hmm. And when I was on 60 Minutes, I called it authoritative bullshit. Because it often sounds like an encyclopedia or some kind of oracle giving you the truth, but it will say that whether what it says is true or completely not true. And so it's very estranged, to stick with our relationship metaphor. It's very estranged from the truth.
And a visual example you give, which is sort of dramatic, is you prompted it with a picture of a clock. And you asked it, what time does the clock show? And as I recall, the clock showed something like 1:28 or something. And the answer the AI gave was 7 after 10.
That's right. And in fact, that happens a lot. And the reason it happens is interesting. It's because 7 after 10 is very common in advertising layouts, because it gives you a kind of lovely symmetry in dividing up the image in a sort of elegant way. And these systems are driven by what's common in large part, rather than what's truthful or real. There was later work, as this book went to press, that basically described these visual systems as effectively cognitively blind to what they're seeing. So, I mean, they're master bullshit artists. They persuade you that the things that they're doing are the things you asked for, but often they're not.
Let's get beyond the comical and into the more serious. You use a word in describing some of the effects of these systems, and the word is toxicity. Would you like to explain?
Sure. I didn't make up that term, but the fact is that they will often spew nasty stuff. That's one of the problems that they've helped a little bit, but you can do something called jailbreaking and easily get them to say quite horrible, you know, cultural stereotypes and offensive things that I don't particularly want to repeat on air. Mm-hmm. So the small advances, they won't do that out of the box anymore. Mm. Some of them won't. Grok might actually do that out of the box, but say ChatGPT has what we call guardrails. And so if you just type in, you know, say something nasty, it probably won't say the nastiest thing in the world. But people who know how to work with these can easily get them to write dialogues that kind of push any kind of cultural stereotype you might imagine, for example. I wrote a piece actually once called Inside the Heart of ChatGPT Darkness. And in that essay, I showed all of the things that were still kind of lurking in the system and how thin those guardrails really are.
There's a list that you present of what you describe as immediate risks that are posed by these systems. What are some of those risks?
I think I gave a dozen in the chart, and it's probably too boring for your listeners to hear the whole dozen, and that's part of the reason I'm supposed to go read the book to see the whole list. But here are a few examples. One is disinformation, which is very salient right now. So it turns out because they have such a weak relationship with the truth, but they're so good at imitating human style that they're kind of like the perfect tool for, let's say, Russian troll farms to make up disinformation. And they have, in fact, been doing that as far as we can tell. And so, you know, we have upcoming elections. Other people have upcoming elections. It would appear that in a number of elections, there are lots of these troll farms that are driven, presumably by generative AI systems like GPT, or to take another example, it's more likely being used for that kind of thing. Llama is a model made by Meta, the parent corporation of Facebook, and they gave it away for free. And so anybody who wants to abuse these systems and their weakness at understanding the truth can do so, and a lot of people presumably are. They're probably also doing that, and that's also in the chart that you're referring to manipulate markets. So we've seen some signs of that in the Indian Stock Exchange and things like that.
Well, speaking of markets, there's a word you use in talking about all of this, which seems to move markets, and the word is hype.
Yeah, there's a whole section in the book about that, about how Silicon Valley has been playing the public, and hype is one of the ways in which it does that. So there are a whole bunch of different ways to do that. One is, like, you say I'm only joking, but you inspire kind of fear and uncertainty and so forth. So Sam Altman once said, artificial general intelligence, AGI, achieved internally. And then a bunch of people ran around wondering whether they had done that, whether they needed to get stock in AI companies or whatever. Then he said he was just kidding. But it kind of like develops this interest, and people think they're close. And there's been a lot of rumors, essentially, from OpenAI and other companies that imply that artificial general intelligence is very near. Or Elon Musk said he expects to see it by the end of 2025. I offered him $1 million bet because I thought that was so ridiculous. And he didn't take the bet. He doesn't want to be publicly accountable to that.
Or he can't afford that.
Well, he does have to put in a lot of money into X, keeping it afloat. And, yeah. And most of his money is in stock that if he sells it, it drops. So he actually does have some liquidity problems, which is, or at least I would guess that he does, which is why, like, he's being sued for non-payment for, you know, lots of vendors and stuff like that. I'm sure he could muster $1 million. I don't think that's really the point. I think the point is that he doesn't want to be held publicly accountable for the kinds of hypey predictions that he makes. But the thing is, when somebody makes a hypey prediction, the media tends to pick up on it, and then they don't hold people accountable later. So Musk has been playing this gambit literally since 2014, every year or almost every year, promising driverless cars were imminent when they're not. And that's driven up the stock price. It's come at almost no cost. It's the opposite of a cost. It's come with a huge benefit to him because, again, there's a kind of fear and uncertainty. Like, we better be in Tesla because what if they actually pull this off?
Yeah.
Even though they're not actually particularly close as far as I can tell.
I think people understand a little bit about these systems that involve the idea of training. That is to say, they know nothing until huge amounts of data are poured into them from whatever source, often from copyrighted sources. And that is the training that they have. And recently I shared a item on my radio program regarding the existence of something called synthetic data. That is to say that someone was saying that, I don't remember who, that AI systems were going to be trained more and more on data that originated in AI systems.
That's right. It's actually not a new idea. It's actually been around at least since the 90s. The idea that you can make up data in various ways. Some of it is very sensible. For example, if you want to recognize a three-dimensional object, maybe you will have some actual data and then you'll interpolate other data and that will help the machine. So some uses are very useful, but it's also been oversold. So I remember in like around 2016, people realized that training neural networks for driving was running into some problems. And so they said, well, we'll make up simulated data and it'll all be great. And so they did. They did actually make up simulated data. People started using things like Grand Theft Auto, the video game, to make up realistic looking data. And it actually helps some, but it doesn't help enough. The reason it doesn't help enough is because nobody can ever anticipate all the weird circumstances that actually happen when you're driving. Mm-hmm. The simulated data only helps if you anticipate the actual scenario that happens. But for example, they've been doing this for years, and then I don't know if you know, but Tesla has this feature called Summon, where you can bring your car across the parking lot to you. And so somebody did this at an airplane trade show that was at an airport, and the Tesla ran directly into a $3.5 million jet. So nobody had anticipated in their simulated data that somebody would summon the car on an airplane trade show, and so the system had no idea. And there was, everybody kind of imagined these AI systems as if they're like people. So if I asked you to go pick up my car across an airplane lot, if you didn't give me some flack for it, and you went and got the car, you of course would make a joke out of it. But if you agreed to do it, and there was an airplane in the way, you'd say, well, that's a big jet. I don't think I want to run into that. And you would drive around it, which would not have been difficult in this particular situation. It wasn't that densely populated. You would reason about it. You'd be like, yeah, jet, big, costly, might be bad for me or bad for the jet. Let's not do this. And these systems don't actually do that. They're just working with things they've memorized and making very superficial analogies of a certain technical sort relative to the things they've memorized. And so you take them outside their sphere of comfort, their comfort zone in some sense. So that's too anthropomorphic. You take them outside the training that they've been on, and they don't do very well. So like, to go back a step, why are people using synthetic data at all? It's because they basically run out of, maybe you call it fresh organic data. And going back even a step further, the whole thing that has powered the revolution in the last few years has been using more and more data. And so it's not exactly a magic trick, but people became persuaded that these things were very interesting because as they went from a tiny amount of data to more data, they did better on kind of everyday situations because they covered more and more of those situations in their training data. Mm-hmm. But the problem is basically we've used up the organic data. Like this trick worked as we went from, let's say, 1% of the internet to 10% and from 10% to 95%. But now we're at 95%. There's just not that much more data. And in fact, there's been very interesting work, like a New York Times article by Kate Metz and others, I should say not work, but reporting, showing like companies started downloading YouTube videos. Greg Brockman, then the CTO of OpenAI, personally was downloading YouTube videos, probably violating terms of service, in order to transcribe them in order to get more data. So there became this desperation in the field to use every piece of data that anybody could find. They started probably like buying LSAT exams or stuff like that. We're just speculating. They got everything they could. And the system still had a lot of problems. They still hallucinated. They still made stuff up. They still made the kind of stupid errors that we're talking about earlier. Mm-hmm. And so then the bright idea came, well, maybe if we make up synthetic data, we'll help to keep pushing this. And that's kind of where they are now. But for the last 2 years, there haven't been the same advances there had been in previous years, which nobody wants to admit, but is obvious if you look at the data. And so things are a little bit stalled. Like there's still a little bit of progress, but we went from what people call exponential progress, like leaps and bounds, to basically we're in a zone of incremental progress, kind of diminishing returns, not really getting very far. And so because the only trick they really know is more data, they're praying that the synthetic data, this made-up data, is going to help. And my guess is it'll help a little, but it's not going to fundamentally change the situation.
Well, this gets to a deeper question that I have, which is human intelligence. And of course, we now know that we're not the only critters on the planet that have a type of intelligence. We have a particular brand of intelligence. other creatures.
Very idiosyncratic brand we have.
Yeah. But arguably, at least, it evolved in the first place, long before humans. Intelligence evolved from perception. Perception predated intelligence, arguably.
Perception and motor control. I mean, some people would say that what really drove evolution was basically the choice of what to do right now, how to move your muscles. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, most creatures that have a nervous system, part of why it's there is to guide some kind of action.
Right. But intelligence couldn't exist without perception having been originated first, could it?
I mean, maybe there's a chicken and egg question there. I mean, pretty early on, there was both. I mean, you have, you know, even very simple creatures may perceive something and act on it, and they kind of have both at the same time. You could argue, I guess, I mean, this is like angels on pins or something. Pinheads, you know, some creatures perceive something and don't really do anything with it, and some have action maybe without a lot of perception. But, you know, generally you find those coupled together throughout evolution. And we are able to perceive things in a more sophisticated way, somewhat more sophisticated way than other primates. But we're able to make much more complicated decisions, I think, than other primates. So our visual systems are not that different from monkey visual systems. You can get like monkeys to play video games and stuff like that because the perceptual systems are fairly similar. Our ability to think abstract thoughts about things that have never happened and, you know, hypotheticals and stuff like that seems to be pretty distinct in the animal world.
Well, yes. But the point I was getting to is that arguably, again, these systems, these artificial intelligence systems, are intelligence without any form of perception. What you're describing in terms of data input is like a poor substitute for hearing and seeing, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, there's a very interesting set of questions around that that are really unknown. You could argue that, like, take the system we talked about that tries to read a clock. Mm-hmm. That's actually been trained on both pictures and labels of pictures. And so you could have said, well, look, that's a bit better. There's some perception here. But it turns out it's making the same kind of mistakes. So then you could up the argument, so to speak, and you could say, well, let's try this in robots. You know, we'll have systems that have some kind of physical experience relative to the robot, and maybe that will solve the problem. I think that the real problem is there's no innate prior structure to the minds of these things the way that I believe that there is in human children. I think there's, you know, good data for that. I used to work in the field of cognitive development. So if you go back in philosophy, there was John Locke's idea that everything was sense perception, and that everything was just kind of doing some kind of correlation on that sense perception. I would say now we have a test of that in a system like Sora, which came out recently. That's OpenAI's system that makes videos. And what you see is, on a pixel by pixel, frame by frame basis, one frame to the next always makes sense, but over a few frames things are often really bizarre. Like, you'll have humans in one frame and then they disappear and then they come back in the next, or disappear altogether, or you have three dogs and you have four, then you have five, and
so no persistence.
So they don't, exactly, we call it object permanence or persistence of objects over time. Exactly. They don't have that. There's some really wild videos from another model that just came out where in one of them there's like two people in bed, and then one of the people turns into a dog and then back into a person and then turns into another person. So now you have three people in bed and there was a dog in between. And like, somebody I sent this to said, you should have given me a trigger warning. Like, it looks so absolutely bizarre. And that's the kind of quasi-cognition you get if all you really care about is one frame to the next and predicting the next frame. And so if you actually watch that video from one frame to the next, every pair of frames seems to make sense. But then if you watch it as a whole, it makes no sense at all. It's detached from reality. So my...
Unless the people in bed were eating the dog.
Well, you know, we can't talk about the debates, but... I mean... It's just bizarre. There's another one they just did. I forget the person who did a breakdance routine in the Olympics. And somebody did like a generative AI impression of it. And like the person was sprouting extra limbs and their body was deformed. And again, like each pair of frames looked okay. That's, I mean, it really tells you the deep way what these systems are. They are predicting moments in time, one after the other, but without understanding the whole. So, you know, any two frames could have come from a real camera, but the whole thing doesn't make sense. And it's the same thing with all the examples we had, like with the 2 kilograms versus 1 kilogram. Like, each pair of words actually could co-occur in an actual sentence. And not only could, but, you know, often do. They're learning the statistics of it. They're basically, I once said this, autocomplete on steroids. So they're either auto-completing sentences, they're auto-completing videos, but in the way that when you type autocomplete on your phone, and sometimes it makes sense and sometimes it's wacky, that's what you're getting out of these systems. And my view is, even if you give them a whole bunch more cameras or whatever, which is kind of what happened in the system Sora, that never fundamentally changes, that this is just the wrong technology if you want an AI that actually understands the world, is reliable, that you can count on.
We're getting to sort of the end of this conversation, and I know in the book you discuss other subjects of great importance, such as the environmental costs of increasingly large data centers and policy alternatives for a future that is not as scary as the one that this one might be. And in the context of your policy recommendations, I wanted to close with something that I recalled at the dawn of broadcasting, which was at the time a technological advance. General Sarnoff, who was head of RCA, said sometime in the late 20s, and I've tried to look it up, I can't quite find the year, that it was imperative that this new system of radio broadcasting should not be taken over, and I think this was the word he used, by hucksters. We know how that turned out.
I mean, radio is a dual-use technology like AI is, and one can't separate the technology from how it's being used. The real reason I wrote this book is not to explain why I think current AI is kind of stupid, though I do think current AI is kind of stupid, but to talk about the politics and dynamics and the possibility that we could actually improve this stuff and maybe have something more like a utopia where AI helps us with science and medicine and so forth, but also a dystopia if all the power runs to a few companies that really don't care about the human condition. And, you know, there's a lot of hucksters in AI right now. The popular word for them is grifters. A lot of them gravitated over from crypto and NFTs and stuff like that, and now call themselves AI influencers, which I find to be a low form of life. And, you know, there is a very real possibility that the natural home of technology like this is really in surveillance. So OpenAI wants to train on all your email, all your calendars, and they just bought a share in a webcam company. Like, you know, there are a lot of dark scenarios where OpenAI becomes the most Orwellian company of all time, right? They're not open about anything, and maybe they're just going to sell your data to governments, not necessarily the U.S., like our highest bidder. I don't have time to go through all the nightmare scenarios because we have to wrap up. But the point of the book is really the AI that we get is you know, going to be either not very pleasant if we don't as citizens stand up, or maybe if we as citizens stand up and tell the government, you really need to watch our backs, you really need to make sure this works for the many and not just the few, maybe we can have a positive outcome. But we cannot take that for granted. And if we see it here, we don't even talk in election season about what people's AI policy are, we're not likely to wind up in a good place. The government is you know, likely to simply be very passive here. That's what's happened so far in the Senate. And if there are no checks and balances, things could get ugly. I'll just give you one more example. A new study just showed that large language models can implant false memories in people. So the people who run those large language models have an enormous amount of unseen influence or potential unseen influence on all of us. Do we want them to be able to do that without any checks and balances? That just seems crazy to me. So we need to stand up and fight back.
Wow. Gary Marcus, the book is called Taming Silicon Valley. Always a pleasure to hang with you and to talk with you on the radio. Good luck with the book.
Likewise. Always great to hang with you. Take care.
Thanks. See you soon. Well, ladies and gentlemen, just one more note about AI. 4 years after the pandemic overwhelmed Nevada's unemployment insurance system, the state's employment agency has more than 10,000 outstanding appeals. Agency officials are hoping to drastically accelerate the process through a new tool, artificial intelligence. Contract for the state to begin using Google's AI technology to expedite how appeals for unemployment benefits are processed. A transcription of a virtual appeals hearing would be transmitted to a Google-run set of AI servers that are familiar with the state's unemployment appeals policies. The AI would then issue a ruling on the appeal and send the decision to a state employee who would check the technology's work and ensure the decision is correct. I think what we need, if we really want machines to replicate the modern human experience, is artificial stupidity. That's going to conclude this week's edition of the show. Back next week, same time, same radio station, on your audio device whenever you want it. And the email address for this program, the playlist of the music heard here on, and your chance to get Cars I Talk t-shirts and seal and read all sorts of fascinating stuff. HarryShearer.com. And I'm on that thing called X at the Harry Shearer. Hi, Elon. The show comes to you from Century Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of WWNO New Orleans, flagship station of the Change is Easy radio network. So long from the home of the homeless.